from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in your backyard or in a local park where you might see some bursts of color. And I'm not talking about the flowers this hour. I'm referring to the yellows, the oranges, the reds of the mushrooms, the fungus among us. July has been a very wet month. And as we enter its last week, the Rochester area could potentially have the rainiest on record for the month of July. That's according to local meteorologists. July 2021 is already in the top five wettest on record. This month, we've seen more precipitation than in March, April, May, and June combined. And with the rain has come the mushrooms in a lot of places. The wet conditions are optimal for fungi to fruit. I think that would be the verb. I don't know. I really don't know. I don't know a lot about this stuff. That's why we're here this hour. And if you're frustrated or confused about what you're seeing pop up in your yard, it's probably just nature doing its thing. But maybe you're wondering about your soils, your pHs, what you're growing, if it's an issue. Maybe it's a reminder of how little we think about or how little control we have of what's happening underground or what's happening, frankly, with climate change. This hour, we're talking about changes in a lot of different ways. Changes that we can make during a growing season that's been getting a lot of rain, really the opposite of last July. We'll talk about monocultures, about biodiversity in green spaces, and our guests will answer some of your questions about what's going on in your yard and maybe how to do it better. Let me welcome our guests now. Marcy Muller is a horticulture program leader with Cornell Cooperative Extension of Monroe County. Marcy, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Allison Espinoza, also with Cornell Cooperative Extension, an urban agriculture educator. Allison, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon.
And Noreen Reardon is on the line with us, a certified arborist with Monster Tree Service. Not a big fan of monoculture, I don't think. Noreen, welcome. Thanks for making time for the program.
Thanks very much.
All right. So Marcy, you know, was trying to set me straight before this program because I'm going, Marcy, it's the wettest July ever and we're all drowning and all I got left is mushrooms. It's not the wettest ever. I mean, it's pretty wet. But, I want to talk a little bit about what we're seeing right now. And if you're worried or if you find the mushrooms an issue, what we need to know about it. Let's start there. Is this a concern for you?
No. Okay.
That's the end of the hour, everybody. Thanks for coming.
The fungus is there all the time, underground. Their root-like structure, they're referred to as mycelium. They're extremely important to the health of the plants. They help bring more water and nutrients into the plant in exchange for some sugar to help them grow. And they also help the plants communicate with each other underground. So they're extremely important to the biology of the soil. When you see the mushrooms, that is, you're correct, that's called the fruiting bodies. And they come up and then they release the spores and then they go away. If there's mushrooms in your mulch or there's mushrooms in your yard, you know, a good hard raking gets some air in there, and they'll dry up and go away.
It's not a sign of a lack of health.
No.
Okay. How many are you seeing, Allison Espinoza?
I'm actually out in Ontario County, and I see a bunch pretty much everywhere I go. I have a little bit over an acre, and I also do have livestock, and so I see mushrooms very often in my yard. And it's mainly – that's actually a sign of a lot of organic material in the soil. Mushrooms are generally sometimes actually looked at as an indicator of soil health, depending on the type that you get. And from what I can tell, the mushrooms sort of emerge, but usually, just like Marcy mentioned, they're underneath the surface there, breaking down organic material into the soil. And you actually want mushrooms to show up in a way for your, depending on what you're doing, of course. If you're not doing anything, then it's actually a nice marker of soil health. But those of us that have animals, you know, these are some things that we may want to be cognizant of, especially if we have, you know, household pets, dogs, cats, things like that. And I'm actually a certified vet tech, so I'm happy to talk about toxicity and things like that.
Can you briefly, because there's this beautiful dog that I would never want to go just having a salad in the backyard because the mushrooms are colorful. What I don't know is they don't seem to last very long. And some of these mushrooms pop up and they're pretty big, but they don't seem to last very long. But sometimes they get plucked off and they fall over and now they're loose on the soil. And I'm worried that an animal is going to pick it up and eat it. And I don't know what happens there. Would you be concerned about that?
So the ones that if no one here is a mushroom connoisseur, okay. Now, the ones that we mainly want to look for that are the quote-unquote storybook-looking ones, so the umbrella-looking mm-hmm. mushrooms, those are the, for sure, in a way, you want to keep your pets away from those. But then there are some that vary very greatly in their appearance. So the finger-like looking tops, we try to keep the dogs away from those as well. But there's no real way of knowing. You can just assume. You should just assume.
Always assume yeah. they shouldn't be eating.
Yeah, yeah. Just assume you don't want your dog munching on them because it's not as if they're a nutritional value for your dog and they should be a part of their dietary, daily dietary needs. But I would say, most likely the more umbrella looking ones, so those quintessential looking mushrooms, we want to keep our dogs from eating those. But really, most of the time dogs will stay away from them. Most of the time dogs do stay away from it.
Yeah, that's a happy outcome there. Noreen Reardon, are you concerned about this particular growing season and what we're seeing right now?
I'm not particularly concerned about the mushrooms you see in the lawn. As a matter of fact, I kind of like watching squirrels eat them because it's like they're eating a little pizza all around the edges. And like you said, they go away after a while. There are some fungal diseases that have been quite prevalent this year in different crab apples and trees that tend to get apple scab. They're very unsightly. The leaves fall off. There are a series of fungus mushrooms type things in trees, though, that are completely different and would really necessitate a good look at because there are some indications of decay in trees. That's not really what we're talking about here.
Okay. Well, all right. So you're already all making me feel a little bit better about the mushroom situation. It has been such a different year. And I'm sitting here kind of at my wit's end just trying to grow grass because I'm not a fan of laying down sprays, chemical agents, et cetera. I've worked really, really hard to sort of just replant by hand and grow grass. And then it comes and it lasts a few weeks and then it sort of fades and there's a lot of shade. And I'm sitting here going, should I not be growing a monoculture at all? Should I just give this up? Should this be the end of the grass experiment? Because I live in the city of Rochester. I love the neighborhood. There's old big trees. It's not easy to grow. I've tried fescue grasses and different kinds. And I don't know if it's just this particular summer or if I should just quit it and just put down a new garden bed, put down stones, put down an herb garden. Let me start with Marcy Miller on that. Am I too discouraged here?
No, I think you're right on the right track.
To see us diversify.
Yes.
Okay,
and I'll qualify this, and I apologize to all you turf people, but I'm not necessarily a huge fan of lots of lawn, especially when it's not. Grass is one of the highest maintenance plants you can grow. It needs full sun. It needs lots of water. It needs all kinds of nutrients added to it, and which means it's going to grow. And then you got to mow it all the time. And then, they're prone to diseases and insects, blah, blah, blah. So in the shade, it's sort of a losing battle. And so definitely would recommend to not try and grow grass. Let the grass, where the grass wants to grow, where the grass looks good, that's where the conditions are right for it. Everywhere else, put some mulch down. Trees and shrubs have to compete with the grass for water and nutrients, so you're making your trees healthier by putting mulch down and not having the grass there. Yes, the monoculture sort of thing is, when something comes in that's going to affect that grass, it's going to affect the whole property. Whereas if you have more variety, then, certain areas are going to not be affected.
I think every time I start to feel like I'm getting Marcy's mentality, here's what happens. I go to Abbott's Ice Cream at the port, and then I take a walk at the secret sidewalk out there. These beautiful homes right on the lake, but I'm telling you, those lawns are, mm-hmm. I mean, it is a museum of perfect grass. I don't know what's happening. They've got a lot of sun that I don't have. But I don't even want to ask questions about how you achieved this. I don't want to know. Nobody email me. Don't tell me. I don't want to know. Don't ruin this for me. If you live on the secret sidewalk, I love your beautiful lawns. But I think I have to get close to maybe parting ways with my own dream of that, especially in a shady neighborhood. And let me ask the other guests. Allison Espinoza, what do you think?
I'm going to have to go with Marcy on this as well. I'm very much so about, I'm actually an herbalist, so I'm all about growing herbs where you can. And so I'm more of the mindset of, okay, well, if it's too shady and it gets bogged down with water, let's look at water-loving plants and shade-loving plants at that point. So that's more of my mindset. I don't know about anyone else, but.
And what kind of shade-growing plants or shade-loving plants do you like?
I particularly love anything that, of the iris family. So irises do very, very, very well in shadier areas as well as waterlogged. So if it gets waterlogged there, irises do love water. Same with cardinal flower. And I'm always try to give the idea of perennials so that, you know, not too much upkeep. So you don't have to regularly go and plant them. And then as for herbs, water-loving herbs, marigold is another water-loving plant. But I also love basil, rosemary. Rosemary can get waterlogged, but you do want it in a full sun area. There are quite a lot of herbs, actually, that are water-loving herbs. So let's see, lemon basil. Mm. I don't know if anyone likes lemon balm, but lemon balm is another one, and mint. All varieties of mint.
But mint really tries to take over. Like, you can't really reason with mint.
No. So, no, mint you cannot reason with. But what I do like to do with mint is regularly, honorably harvest it. And when I say honorably harvest, I mean I literally will take huge chunks before she takes over an entire area. So, yes, that does happen.
I thought you were going to say you take, like a shovel and just dig it straight out of there. No, but you're...
Yeah, I regularly prune it.
Pruning it.
Yeah. And what I call it honorably harvesting it is because I really am trying to curb the growth a little bit.
I love that. Yeah. Noreen Reardon, are we speaking your language now on how we should be approaching our own space?
Most definitely. And I think if you were to see some shade gardens along the properties that you're talking about, they can be just as beautiful as the perennial gardens. They might not have as much color in them, but they also have a lot of texture and different sizes and shapes of foliage. Absolutely stunning plants like goat's beard and maidenhair fern and tiarella and stilbe. I mean, it's absolutely magical what you can put under a tree or in a shady spot. You don't have to be limited by what grows in the sun.
Listeners, I would love to hear from you on this. How are you doing with this growing season? That has been pretty wet in July. Marcy has sort of talked me down about this particular July, but I am really thinking about making some changes. Maybe you're someone who has really changed your mentality about what a yard or a lawn should be. Whether it's saying we're going to grow grass, but if there's weeds, we're okay with it. We're not going to use weed killers or different herbicides. Or maybe you've changed entirely how you've laid out the structure of that property. I'd love to hear from you. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. And I want to read an email from a listener that I think gets at one of the challenges here. You can make changes. But sometimes you feel pressure based on where you live, if you live in a neighborhood or if there's different sort of community standards. So this is from Manny, who says, Evan, I live in a neighborhood with an overrepresentation of busybodies who literally walk around the neighborhood with a ruler and measure people's grass length. They've reported me to the city multiple times as soon as anything in my lawn hits more than 10 inches. It's very frustrating. If I use herbicides, that helps because weeds grow much faster than grass. I do not want to use herbicides, and so some of the weeds cultured in the lawn can spring up over 10 inches literally overnight. I cannot go around mowing every other day, but on the other hand, I'm frustrated with dealing with these, to use his phrase, grass length Nazis. What can I do? I'm looking for a very low maintenance yard, perhaps an alternative to grass altogether. Thank you for any help. Let me start with the urban agriculture educator with Cornell Cooperative Extension, Allison Espinoza. What would you say, Allison?
That sounds very tedious. I have to say, just to preface my answer, is I sort of wish I had that much time on my hands to be the busybody. I really do. I would do something different with it, but I just wish I had that amount of time. Now, with that being said, you know, I do feel that that particular homeowner's pain there. And I do understand that there may be pressures from, you know, the neighborhood and folks. But definitely looking at the space, sort of, I would want do a little bit of an assessment the way you would for like any gardening site, you know, assess where the weeds are really coming in, how often, you know, when he's noticing that occurring, and maybe trying to, you know, like we had mentioned earlier, planting in some of these spaces in a way that it's relevant. So if he doesn't want to do too much maintenance and he's got a nice shady area, there was a ferns mentioned earlier for shade, water loving. I would try really honestly to look at my area and do a little bit of garden design and landscaping. And that is where Marcy comes in, of course, for the landscaping piece and looking at where to put things. I wouldn't want to deal with something like that on a long term. So, you know, if it's the stress of maybe he doesn't want to maintain the lawn and have it be perfect, and maybe some other is open to other plants, maybe some raised beds would be worth it. Or maybe even looking into some plants that are of like resistant to the growth of other plants.
Yeah, I think there's actually two challenges. One is exactly what you described, but I think you've got to find a way to make some peace with the neighbor.
Right.
Or at least say, hey, this is a little unfair here.
Right.
And we all want to coexist peacefully and happily. And I'm doing my best XYZ. So good luck to you, Manny, on that. But what do you think? Do you want to add to what Allison is saying there?
Yeah, I would just say, depending on the size of the area, you know, if it's not very big, there's any number of perennials that will stay low that grow thick. Some of the perennial geraniums, some of the, you know, plants that are more like ground cover, even some daylilies, things like that, you can mix in and make a perennial garden. But if it's a little bit larger and you want it to give the appearance of lawn, there's a great plant called birdsfoot trefoil, which is a legume. It's related to alfalfa and clover, and it in the full sun, and it never gets more than 6 inches tall, has a nice yellow flower right through the summer, and, you know, well, we always used it for putting on banks where we wanted to hold it, and it was too hard to mow, but something along that line would, you know, from the distance. I read a book once, and it talked about two different kinds of lawns. One is what they called the industrial lawn, which is, you know, the lawn that gets all the treatment and all the attention and constant maintenance. And then there's what I have at my home, which is called the freedom lawn. And but nowadays they refer to that more as a pollinator lawn. And those are not, it's not your, you know, PGA golf course kind of lawn. Mm-hmm. And we need to embrace that there's nothing wrong with that.
I could not agree more on that. Noreen Reardon, you want to add to that? Go ahead.
I think part of the issue might be there's too much lawn to maintain, and therefore trying to reduce the amount of lawn that he's got to contend with is a good idea. He could put in some more trees and some shrubs and some ground covers, and after a while it all sort of grows in together, which reduces the amount of work, especially when you're using native plants. They don't need as much tending to.
Mm-hmm.
And also some of the things that you can do to emulate the look of some of the formal gardens that people are used to, like boxwoods, as you can find a substitute plant that grows in the same way, you know, like an inkberry holly or that sort of thing, so that you're fitting in with the neighborhood to a certain extent, but you're also putting your own stamp on it and using a better plant that doesn't require as much work.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say to Manny, it was a few years ago, I did an enormous amount of work to kind of reclaim some old beds that a previous owner had really neglected. And that work, in the middle of the work, days which became weeks, thinking this is not worth it. Now it's pretty low maintenance. It's beautiful. It involves, I pull some weeds by hand that I don't really sort of aesthetically like, but there's a mix of things that are there. They're all pretty well self-sustained. Sometimes I throw some annuals for pops of color, but really that has been so rewarding. I get to end of May into June, and I know I'm putting one hard weekend into really bringing things up. But once that happens, it's not that nothing has to happen, but the amount of work is so much less than trying to make a huge lawn perfect all the time. Joel sends two pictures of massive mushrooms from his yard. That is a 12-inch diameter mushroom.
Oh, yeah.
I'm showing Allison. That's pretty good right there.
Wow.
And then he sent that guy that fell over.
Oh, the puffball.
That's a puffball mushroom. Okay.
Yeah. So you can eat those. They're delicious. Oh, I'm not supposed to say that in public, so. We're not supposed to encourage people to eat mushrooms.
But. Okay. I'm looking at two humongous mushrooms. But what Joel says is the city of Rochester should change its policy to permit wild flower-filled lawns. City council people, are you listening? Well, of course they're listening. Everyone's listening to Connections, Joel. And maybe on the policy side, maybe there's a chance to at least revisit, you know, sort of what's allowed or what you can do. I mean, does something stand out to you, Allison? Is there something you'd want to see change to allow people a little bit more autonomy in what they're doing?
Quite honestly, I feel like folks who have a set plan should be able to implement their set plan with assistance. You know, and that's sort of what Monroe County CCE here is for a lot of resourcing. So that's why we're open to the public, so that folks can be able to really come to us with any of their concerns, questions. We're quite accessible, really, to the community. And I do feel like with a lot of policies that people have set in place, you know, everything's about trying to go by the rules. And we can try to make you go by the rules as much as possible, but also having a little bit of your individuality to it. And at least that's what I think about it all. You know, I'm a rule follower, but Marcy just broke a rule. But for the most part, we follow the rules. But I do feel, especially as the urban ag person here for Cornell, I definitely have the interest in going through the guidelines, but also really seeing what the needs are and reassessing as needed, because not everything goes by everyone else's standards.
Your time is short, so let me just squeeze in one more question for you. A listener sends an email saying, Evan, let's remember the history of how lawns came to be a status symbol of the rich, stating that they were wealthy enough to waste their property unproductively with plants that are not edible or medicinal. Now being able to grow your own food is the status symbol. I, the history of lawns we could talk about on a separate show, I'm sure, and a lot of people have shared thoughts on that. But I think we shouldn't we be encouraging everyone to have the chance to grow their own food, and it shouldn't just be a status symbol of wealthy people, I would think.
100%. So urban agriculture is all centered around teaching, education, empowerment, because that's a big piece of urban agriculture and growing your own food is that piece of empowerment. And really, that's what urban ag is trying to do is the reverse, is those that do not, who are from socially disadvantaged who disproportionately experience health, worse health outcomes, I would say, and from disparate areas, you know, these are also the status symbols for these folks of being able to make their own, you know, produce their own food, grow their own food. Container gardens have become, you know, the new coolest thing is, you know, container gardening. So let's say you don't have an acre or half an acre, you can, you know, do so from your patio, you know, grow from your patio.
And not just for people with
who have the money. But if you have the space, and that, I think that's probably why Marcy is less of a lawn person, is because if you do have the space, it makes sense to grow as much as possible.
I'm grateful for your time. I know you have got to get out of here, but so let me just reset this hour. Allison Espinosa is an urban agriculture educator with Cornell Cooperative Extension in Monroe County. Please come back and continue these conversations with us.
Oh, I would love to. Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to let her go, and after our only break, we're going to come back with Marcy Muller from Cornell Cooperative Extension, and Noreen Reardon is on the line with us, a certified arborist with Monster Tree Service. Let's take that break, and we've got a lot more of your questions coming in on a wide range of subjects as you navigate a growing season that is wet. You know what? Let's be clear about this. We're going to have a lot of wet seasons. Climate change means that sometimes we're going to have heavier precipitation. Sometimes we're going to have to deal with that. So what do we do about it this year? Are you concerned about what you're seeing? Are you making changes to what you're growing? We're talking about all of that and more coming up.
I'm Megan Mack. Tuesday on The Next Connections, we bring you NPR's coverage from Washington, D.C. Tuesday is the first day of hearings from the Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Five people died in the insurrection, and it caused about $1.5 million in damage to the Capitol building. You'll hear the proceedings live here on WXXI, and we'll be back with you for Connections on Wednesday.
This is Veronica Volk from WXXI News, and we've got a new weekly podcast for you. It's called Earshot, and it's got all the most important, best told, sometimes off the beaten path news stories from your favorite WXXI and city reporters. Earshot comes out every Friday. Don't miss it. Subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Connections at WXXI.org is our email address, and we're getting some great questions and comments about summer growing and where you are with what you're growing and maybe what you're looking for help with or what you're changing or frustrated with. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester. 263-9994. Got a question from a listener about, said, I just caught the tail end of it, Evan. What is this secret sidewalk with all these perfect lawns? Let me just briefly say, I am not disparaging anyone's beautiful lawn, anyone's beautiful anything. People are making their own decisions. And I'm not trying to be here to judge. I am sharing my own frustrations with my own abilities and inabilities at times. But what I'm talking about with the secret sidewalk is if you go up Lake Avenue all the way to the lake, right where Abbott's is, the original Abbott's, and park there, maybe get an ice cream, and then take a walk, head west. The sidewalk will then sweep out toward the lake. And for a moment, you're going to think, I can't walk here. I'm in people's, literally their backyards facing the lake. But that is a public sidewalk. So it's kind of jokingly referred to as the secret sidewalk. I don't know where that came from, but it is beautiful. The homes, the gardens, the lawns are beautiful. The people are almost uniformly very kind and sharing. Some of them have benches out with signs encouraging you to sit and enjoy the view. So it's wonderful. It's really lovely. It's a great walk. It's a great sunset. And the lawns are perfect, and maybe they just always have been and always will be. And that's why I said, don't tell me what you're doing. I don't want to know. But it's beautiful. I love it. And on a subject of just, I know, lawns and grass growing, Marcy Miller from Cornell just wanted to make a point, too. You've got your own preferences, but I know you guys also help people who are making these decisions on lawn growing, right?
Right. And Cornell does a lot of research and has all kinds of tips and for growing lawns, and I wanted to apologize to the turf people out there who are listening, because you're wonderful. Exactly. it's just me.
I also know plenty of turf people, grass people, who don't really use hardly any chemicals at all, and they are out there all the time, and the amount of work they do is, I just admire it.
Yeah.
I don't always have the time for it, right. But I admire it for sure. Noreen Reardon, can I just ask you to jump in too on this idea that what we grow is a status symbol sometimes? I was surprised to hear that growing your own food would be a status symbol, and I think that if that's true, that's dangerous. I think we should celebrate giving everyone the opportunity to grow your own food. But I'm wondering what you think about status symbols and what we are sort of signaling with what we're growing, Noreen.
That's really interesting. And I can use myself as an example here, because I have always been really interested in the exotic plant aesthetic with, you know, different colors of foliage. And I went towards the Japanese maples and the dwarf conifers that were not native. And then I suddenly stood back and realized, you know, this looks really pretty. It looks very cool, but it's not feeding anything. Like, there's no action in here. It's sterile. And then I started reading Doug Tallamy's books about bringing nature home and trying to promote biodiversity in your own yard. And now I'm making up for my errors and intermingling everything with natives. And the new lingo that I heard recently is 2/3 for the birds. And I think you can have status symbol plantings by using that exotic stuff. And it's really helpful to put in some natives as well. And I think in terms of planting food at home, I think last year when everybody was stuck at home, that absolutely exploded. Everybody's got something growing in their backyards. I get to see a lot of backyards in my job, and it's really amazing how many places you pull up to and you think, oh, you know, this is quite a high-profile property. And then you go in the back and there's a beautiful raised bed and tomatoes growing. And I think that's right. It has become something that everybody can do. And it's pretty impressive.
I think that's great. What do you think, Marcy, about the notion of growing a status symbol?
Yeah.
So I'm kind of uncomfortable with the whole idea, to be honest.
Right. Well, I think it just sort of Some people use their landscaping as a way to express, their station in life, as they do with their home. And other people are, do it just because they love plants, or they want to invite nature in, or what, whatever drives them. So there is that element, always has been that element, the newer materials, the newer plants, the biggest plants, the largest trees you can put in at one time, and that kind of thing, kind of statusy. But I think that horticulture and agriculture is a great leveler. And anybody can grow vegetables, like Allison was saying. You don't necessarily need a large space if you just want to grow a tomato plant or something. And there's been a lot of breeding for smaller plants that don't take up a lot of room. So, I think that available for everybody, anybody who wants it. So
yeah,
I think that's the great thing about it.
It can be pretty egalitarian.
Yeah.
And on the subject of tomato plants, for example, here's Jeff in Rochester on the phone. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good, sir.
Hey, I have a few tomato plants growing in some containers on my sidewalk, and I'm starting to get some blossom end rot on my ripe tomatoes. I was wondering if there's anything I can do about that.
Just hold back on the water. I mean, that unfortunately, are they in the ground or did you say they're in containers?
They're in containers.
Okay, so hold back on the watering for a little bit. Stick your hand in the soil. If it feels moist, don't water. If it feels dry, give them some water. But with all the rain that we've had, a lot of the potting mediums media holds a lot of water, so they might be kind of soggy in there, and the plant should grow out of it.
Okay, wonderful. That's good to know.
Anything else that we can help you with before we let you go there, Jeff?
No, I think that's all I have today. Thank you very much for taking
great.
My call.
Good luck to you. And all of a sudden, all the phones. Everybody realize with Jeff's call, they can call. And you're all calling and you're all emailing, which is great. We'll get through as much as we can for the rest of this hour with Marcy Muller from Cornell Cooperative Extension, Noreen Reardon from Monster Tree Service, sharing their thoughts on what we grow and what we choose to plant and how we're sort of setting up our own little landscapes. So Christy says, can your guests share their definitions of weeds and wildflowers? I think there's a lot of confusion in the general public about wildness as a lack of care versus as cultivated, ecologically productive landscaping choices.
Okay.
That's from Christy, and I'll dovetail that with Kevin, who says, I added clover to my lawn, and it's amazing. When I tell people I added clover, most of them say, on purpose? And I say, yes. And he writes, hashtag clover fan. So there you go. So Noreen, let me start with you. How do you define sort of wildflower weed, and how do you, sort of like stratify what those things mean for our spaces?
Sometimes it's personal preference. Sometimes there's, for example, some wild asters that grow along that people would consider a weed, but if you like them and they're in your garden, then they're not a weed for you. I think invasive plants, you can talk about being weeds. We have so many invasive plants now that absolutely take over everything from English ivy to Japanese knotweed, lots of different things that crowd out our native plants. And so that's a way to signify whether it's a weed or not.
Okay. Marcy, what do you think?
So the definition of a weed is something that's growing where you don't want it. So depending on who you are or what your vision is of the area, something that is a desirable plant to you might not be to your neighbor. So it takes me back to the gentleman had the problem with the neighbors coming by and checking his lawn.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people who have taken their front lawns out and put in like a cottage garden with a lot of perennials, the neighbors say, you know, it looks messy. So I think that, especially in the front yard, if you're going to do something like that, maintenance is very important to make sure that you deadhead, that you, you know, cut out, you know, if you have some leaves that fall off color, just so that it always looks good. Make sure you water it when it's dry and don't water it when it's wet, and so that it always presents as beautiful. I think you'll get along with your neighbors better.
Jason in the Highland Park area writes to say, Evan, great topics today. My backyard was full of clover and I was tired of fighting weeds. I also didn't want to resod and treat with chemicals to keep trying with grass. So I built up raised beds and I've been experimenting for several years now. It's not easy, but it's a lot of fun and I learn something new every day. That's from Jason in Highland Park. Marcy says she's smiling. She loves it. What do you think, Noreen?
I think it's fantastic too. And I've seen an awful lot of front yard gardens in some of those city neighborhoods, which people will put down fabric and put paths made of gravel and lots of raised beds, and they're absolutely stunning. It's really tremendous what people are doing nowadays.
All right, Josh in Fairport on the phone next. Go ahead, Josh.
Yeah, hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, just turn your radio down and go ahead.
Yeah, okay, sorry. Just a second.
It's a good lesson for anybody who calls in the future. Thanks to Josh in Fairport for the lesson.
All right.
There you
All
go.
Right. So I have some apple trees growing in the backyard, and it was like a week or two ago. It was like a Saturday, and it rained all day and all night. And the next day, I went out, and the leaves on one of my apple trees were just totally wilting. Like they just looked like they were kind of dragged around town a little bit. So I'm not entirely sure if maybe you have some insight on that.
Okay, well, why don't you hang here because they may have questions about the current state. I'll start with Noreen Reardon, who's a certified arborist with Monster Tree Service. What do you think, Noreen?
I think it's these fungal diseases that we have seen that they're absolutely exploding. They do crinkle up the leaves. They cause brown spots. They cause the leaves to fall off prematurely. The only thing you can do is a preventative treatment in the spring at this point. It's really too late, but it is important to clean up those leaves and get them off the property because spores from those fungus diseases can hang around over the winter and be there in the spring to pop up again.
Oh, boy, oh, boy. Marcy Miller, what would you say?
I agree with Noreen. I mean, that's unfortunately, some of the old varieties are very susceptible to apple scab and some of those other fungal diseases. And if you're planting a new tree, crab apples and apples, they should come with a tag on there that says if they are resistant, and there's really no reason if you're planting a new tree that you don't plant resistant varieties.
Can I ask you, Josh? I mean, what's the status today? I remember that weekend you're talking about, and it was just a constant deluge. So what's the status today?
So I have been keeping an eye on it, and the leaves. There, I would say about 95% of the foliage that I had turned brown and just was drooping and hanging off. So yesterday I actually was doing some pruning and removing of those dead leaves just to see if the remaining leaves would kind of take that as a little boost to keep trying. But I don't know if it'll make a comeback this season.
Boy. Good luck to you. And at the very least, I mean, I'm sure this isn't going to help much, but Noreen, he's not alone, is he?
He's certainly not alone. And we've also had the gypsy moth invasion, and they tend to like crab apples and apples also. So some of our trees have had a really hard time this summer.
Yeah, it has been tough. And, you know, if we talk to friends in other parts of the country, there's just challenges everywhere and a lot of invasive species. It's tough. It's been a tough growing season in some ways. Let me get Robert in Fairport next. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Creeping Charlie has just been terrible this summer. That stuff is, I've never seen it so prolific. I guess it likes the wet weather, but it's ground ivy and it just crowds out grass. I mean, is there any way to get rid of this stuff?
I think you need to get a lawn care company to do some applications. It's really hard to get rid of Creeping Charlie. like I said, it's probably in my yard, but I don't pay attention to it much. But I know I fight it in all my gardens, and it's just so aggressive. It's just really, really hard to eradicate.
Anything you want to add there, Noreen Reardon?
No, I agree. It is a difficult thing to deal with. I have it at my house as well.
So, but Marcia, if it shows up, I mean, I don't have it right now. My old house, I did. Mm-hmm. I don't know what would bring it there. I mean, what's going to make it show up?
Well, it could creep in from a neighbor's lawn or you know, gardens. You know, everything that flowers produces a seed, and so, you know, the seeds might blow in.
So generally it'll kind of move around the neighborhood until it finds you?
Yeah.
Is that also true of henbit, which I had a big issue with years ago?
Yeah, most of those weeds.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it doesn't sound like there's a whole lot of recourse.
Not non-chemical.
Okay, not non-chemical.
Yeah.
So... You know, Robert, you're going to have to capitulate, and it's going to take over your life, I think, is where it's
yeah, saying. Yeah. It or, sounds expensive.
Or maybe a chemical solution, if,
right.
if you're willing to go there. Good luck, Robert. Thank you. It's a hard one. I mean, I don't think I ever solved it at the old, my last house. And henbit either, though. I remember pulling henbit by the handful out of the grass. And then thinking, what am I doing here? This is just going to come right back. Lisa writes to say, Evan, wonderful conversation. I have most of my backyard in raised bed gardening because of a gigantic black walnut and lead safety risks. Mm. But I'm concerned about the amount of poison ivy spreading around the area and our individual yards because of uncontrolled poison ivy whose berries spread from the River Trail and Highland Park. Is there any way these municipalities could remove this so it doesn't spread, putting our pets, kids, and the rest of us at risk? That's from Lisa. Marcy, I'll start with you. I don't know.
You know, that's like the conversation we had about the gypsy moths. You know, there's problems out there. Poison ivy has, you know, is naturalized all over the place. And it would just be a tremendous job to try and eradicate it. So, you know, the best advice is just to, you know, monitor your yard. I do have a little, because I get poison ivy just by thinking about it. And I have a little spray bottle of Weed Be Gone, I think it is, or, you know, Poison Ivy Killer.
It's a Poison Ivy Killer is designated.
Yeah, and we have trails out back that, you know, we hike every night, and whenever I see some pop up, I'll just take it and hit that one plant to keep it off our trails. But, you know, it's a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I sprayed this beautiful plant that was coming up the side of the fence earlier this summer, and when someone pointed out, that beautiful thing that you're so glad adds a pop of color is Poison Ivy. Mm-hmm. And I never touched it, but it has withered away. It is dead. I don't know that it will try to return next year. And I'm not a big fan of using sprays, as I said, but I didn't find a solution other than grabbing that bottle of that poison ivy killer. So that's what I used. So, you know, I sort of felt bad about it, but it's gone. Noreen, are you seeing more of it this year? I mean, as Lisa says in the email, are any issue that you see there?
Yes, absolutely everywhere. And I always point it out to people. A lot of people don't really recognize that that's what it is. So I'm always careful to let people know so that they are aware. And just be careful, Evan, because those stems that are left over after you spray the poison ivy can also cause a reaction on your skin. It's not just the foliage.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes time to pull that, I always tell people, put your hand in a plastic bag, put the plastic bag over the plant, pull it out and turn that bag inside out, so that you're not getting any of that foliage, root, or stem on yourself.
Yeah, that's I appreciate that very much, and that will definitely be the plan for me in the future. This is from Trevor. It says, Evan, in the evening while sitting on my patio, I have little black gnat-like insects that keep landing on my legs, especially the ankle area. They don't bite like black flies, and they don't appear to be fungus gnats like indoor houseplants sometimes have. Also, they're very good at knowing when you're trying to swat them away. Whatever they are, they're very annoying. I don't really have any standing water or decaying matter aside from a compost bin 200 feet away This is a problem we have every summer. Is there anything I can do to keep these insects away? That's from Trevor. What do you think, Marcy?
You need to invite in toads and bats.
Toads and bats will help you. So you need allies.
Right.
Otherwise, they're going to be there.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Agree with that, Noreen?
Sure, and that's where the native plants come in and the native trees and putting up bat houses and the insects that you invite in, the other birds, all those things will work together to help you with that problem. I don't know, all of a sudden I've overrun with fruit flies, so I don't know if he's got fruit flies as well, but they're everywhere all of a sudden.
Before I grab Michael and Victor on the phone, Patrick writes to say, I probably shouldn't be surprised by the amount of urban poison ivy that I've seen. It is just everywhere, especially on rentals. I've seen it growing up playhouses, in hand railings, and taking over our whole garage in Cornhill. I've seen a lot of germinating poison ivy this July. He goes on to say, hey, landlords, put a little more effort in, especially. And regarding landscape maintenance, there is no such thing as a zero maintenance property.
Right.
Mowing your lawn and killing weeds is about as low maintenance as it gets, because nature will reclaim your property, and then you have a much larger issue on your hands. I've seen 15-foot trees growing out of the middle of people's driveways. Addressing that issue while the tree is a sapling is much easier than cutting a stump out of your driveway. It's a fair point. I mean, I'm actually somebody who likes the work. I just don't want to be overwhelmed with the work.
Right.
I like the work. There's a great feeling of accomplishment and just a feeling of satisfaction in doing the work. And I know Noreen and Marcy feel the same. Patrick, I appreciate that. And I really appreciate Patrick's point about backyards. I mean, poison ivy growing on kids' playhouses. Be careful. Be careful. I mean, the reactions of some of this stuff. If you've never had poison ivy, I've never had it in my life. I've been a camp counselor. I've worked in the woods. I've just never run into it. I've been around me, and I do not want to find out because I had a neighbor in the hospital last year. Just be careful. Michael and Victor on the phone next. Go ahead, Michael.
Yes. Hello, Evan. Good show. And hello, everyone. My question is in regards to compost. So if for the last 6 years or so, I've had raised beds for vegetables, and they've been overabundant, and things have gone well. Smaller beds for herbs, they have done well. This year, I chose to incorporate a mixture of compost, which I had never done before, and I kind of did it at like a 3-to-1 ratio and used it for not only those beds, but flowering plants. The flowering plants are doing just well. Every vegetable is not doing well. The spring planting, peas, lettuce, did not do well. And now tomatoes, cucumbers, etc., nothing is growing. They're almost like on life support. Did I need to do something when I put together that mixture with compost?
Well, I guess the question is, Where did you get the compost? I mean, you don't have to tell me, you know, name names, but I mean, did you buy it bulk or did you buy it bagged from the garden center?
It is through one of the organizations that are working with the city of Rochester for food composting.
Okay. I mean, you should, if it's fully composted, it shouldn't cause a problem. If it hasn't broken down, if it's still more organic matter, like if you can identify that this used to be a leaf or this used to be a twig, then as that breaks down, it takes nitrogen from the soil in that breakdown process so it can steal nutrients from the plants. But remember also, this is, you know, we're talking about how wet July has been. But if we go back to when everybody was first planting in May, it was brutally hot and then cold and then hot and then cold. And so I think that that's had a lot of effect. And things were extraordinarily dry at that point. Until we got to the beginning of July, things were very, very dry. We were almost to a low-level drought status. So it's just been a challenge all along. And so it's hard to say about the compost. It should only have done good things. So yeah, I'm having a hard time coming up with an answer for you.
Oh, that is a tough one. And let me just try to squeeze in. Bobby from Penfield said for the first year she's had milkweed, she's not getting any butterflies. What should she do? Noreen, do you want to try to tackle that one?
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel the same way. And I think it was not timed properly this year. It seemed to me like all my milkweed had flowered and then there were butterflies, you know, several weeks later where they kind of missed out on the opportunity to feed. And it also goes along with how our insects are, you know, we're in an insect apocalypse. And one of the main focuses of that is butterflies because people love them so much. You really see how we are losing our insects. And yeah, that's my two cents on that.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's tough. Bobby from Penfield, Michael from Victor, good luck to both of you. I've had such great feedback, and Marcy Muller, just want to give us maybe 30 seconds, some final thoughts about growing and, you know, helping people have a positive mindset for the rest of this growing season.
Yeah, just kind of, you know, keep going. Don't give up. Maybe your harvest is not going to be as bountiful as it has been in the past, or if it's your first time, don't be discouraged. It's just been an incredibly difficult year with extremes of all sorts. And just kind of maybe mentally or write down on paper, keep some notes so that you can remember what happened this year so that if it, you know, comes next year, it won't be such a surprise.
Great point. And 20 seconds, Noreen, final thoughts from you.
Plant more trees.
I love that. I really do, honestly. And as tough as it is, there's so many people who have such a great passion for this. Every time we struggle, we learn. That's true. And we gain experience. And then next year, when it's a little more placid, it's going to be even easier. So I'm just grateful for the time. Noreen Reardon, certified arborist with Monster Tree Service. Thank you, Noreen. Thanks for saying yes. Let's talk again.
My pleasure. Thank you, Evan.
And Marcy Muller, horticulture program leader with Cornell Cooperative Extension of Monroe County. Thank you for the expertise.
Thanks so much. Love being here.
And Allison Espinoza from Cornell joined us earlier this hour. Rob Braden, engineer. Megan Mack, producer. Emma Ray Stein, production assistant. Evan Dawson saying thanks. We'll talk to you tomorrow or Wednesday. We'll see.